Every week, Hillsdale College President Larry P. Arne joins Hugh Hewitt to discuss great books, great men, and great ideas. This is the Hillsdale Dialogues, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. More episodes at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your audio. Also at the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, check out the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arne Show, and more, all at podcast.hillsdale.edu.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I pre-recorded this conversation with Dr. Arne because I wanted to continue our series on the Hillsdale Dialogue, even though I'm at my 45th college reunion in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I didn't want to task Dwayne with talking about H.H. Asquith because I'm fascinated by him and great contemporary. But I did want to ask Dr. Arne, Harvard does a big deal every 5 years. They bring their graduates back, and they make a big deal on the 25th, the 40th, and the 50th, especially. So the 45th is called a, quote, minor reunion. And we just get together and yuck it up with old friends. Does Hillsdale College have a reunion week?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've taken to bringing the 50th and the 60th reunion classes back together. And, you know, it's not a very big college, but we get quite a few. And I've noticed over the years that they're getting younger. It's partly me getting older, but also the numbers are swelling. They're healthier. And it's a hoot. They walk around, you know, they're like tourists because the college is a little different than when they went there. And they admire it, and they talk about it, and it's fun, and they reminisce. It's really great.
Dr. Arne, I got to tell you this. This won't surprise you, but it may appall you. When I called to register, the youngster in charge of registering the reunion goers read us statements about safe spaces and appropriate dialogue during the reunion. I was amazed, actually, because I was just amazed that they would condition the participation on consent not to offend. That's what it boiled down to. Does that amaze you?
It's, So I have an insight about 50th and 60th reunions. First time I went to one way back in 2001, I guess it was, I noticed that they were reverting some to their ways in college because, you know, they start remembering what college was like and they start acting like that. And, you know, some of them were frat boys and they get to drinking. And I said, I wonder to myself, is this going to be a problem? Well, no, they all went to bed at 9:30.
Yes, of course. But the idea that you've got to proselytize the PC world to the older people, 25th, 30th, I'm amused. I'm not offended. I don't give offense to anyone, but they used to. There wasn't a reunion went by that I didn't debate Deval Patrick, my classmate, and a great liberal Democrat, wrong about everything, but a fine guy, and a couple other liberals and Republicans. They've dropped that. They don't want that anymore. They don't want anything remotely resembling. God forbid anybody say a good word about Donald Trump at a Harvard reunion. The ground might open up and swallow you up.
That's right. Yeah, see, and I say this so I'm blue in the face. Colleges proceed on the basis of friendship because you have to talk about stuff that's complicated and high and affects everybody. And the people doing the talking, even the old ones, the faculty members and me, they don't fully understand all that stuff. And so you have to be free to speculate it's your nature. You Hewitt. I'm not going to praise you. My new brain is not different from my old. but you know, you like the guy, right? You disagree with the guy, and you like the guy. And
yes,
that means you can be in a college together. Well, because that's breaking down, they ban all controversial subjects except the official talk, safe spaces and such, which they pretend is not controversial. And if you question that pretense, you're in trouble. See, so now, there's a speech code operating there.
A speech code, and it doesn't develop greatness. We're going to talk about H.H. Asquith. One of the things, I'll give the brief bio here. He was born in 1852 and died in 1928. He was a big deal. He was Prime Minister of the United Kingdom from 1908 to 1916. 8 years. 8 years. And what comes through, and he was Prime Minister at the start of World War I. What comes through is he is got an intellect, Dr. R., right? I mean, he is a smart guy, and he talked everything through.
Yeah. Yeah, and he, I mean, he was very rigorous. Of course, Churchill knew him well. He was the powerful person who fostered Winston Churchill's early career and then abandoned him at a key moment to what Churchill believed was the disaster of his country at the Dardanelles. But Churchill doesn't go into that at length in this thing. He wants to talk about Asquith's character, which is, of course, different for every person. So Asquith was an interesting combination of a man who made up his mind after deep thought and didn't talk about it much. And also, he could shut it off in the most amazing way, right? And Churchill, you know, Churchill criticizes him gently about that because, of course, Churchill was a wild man, and that means anytime a serious subject came up at dinner or anywhere else, he regarded dinner as a major political event and opportunity. Asquith did not. And can you just imagine, by the way, because they spent weeks together, months, Churchill says, twice it was more than a month, on the Admiralty yacht, you know,
yeah,
which is really great, and it's a beautiful yacht, and it's part of the Royal Navy. So it's also a military installation. And that meant, you know, like in the White House, the canteen is called the Navy Mess, and that the Navy runs it. There are naval officers who do the serving and everything. And that's because the Navy is good at that stuff, right? They've got a floating fixed place with a good kitchen, and they can put on the dog for dinner, and they do. And, well, it was an awesome thing, right? And, of course, what you'd think would happen, and what happened everyone else who came on the yacht with Churchill and every yacht he went on to, except with Herbert Henry Asquith, is they talked politics deeply.
They talk shop at dinner.
Not Asquith. And that's a remarkable thing. And Churchill says that he doesn't think that that was a good thing in the case of Asquith. He thought it limited him some.
That yacht trip that we will come back to, he describes that when it was work, it was work. When it was play, Asquith would read Greek or play game after game, quote, the most generals beginning with L's or poets beginning with T. I mean, this is, or he'd go off and read ancient Greek. Asquith was a brilliant guy, but he did not want his games interfered with by guns and stories and rumors of war and war. He wanted to put it away. Does your mind work that way at all? Can you ever turn it off and just say, let's talk about other things that other than headlines?
Well, I'm too much like Winston Churchill, but not as great. And no, it doesn't work that way. Remember about Asquith. Asquith's title, when he became titled after his retirement, was the Earl of Oxford and Asquith. That's an odd title. Why? Well, the answer is he loved his education. He was probably proudest of that. And so he wanted to be the Earl of Oxford, but there already was one. And you have to find a place. And there's a town in Canada called Asquith. And so he's named after two places. And that gave him a unique title, and he could vaunt his Oxford credentials, which he deserved and of which he was very proud.
Yeah, I love the fact that he was a lawyer. And so this is a great thing that a lawyer has the respect of Winston Churchill. Dr. Arne doesn't often, he has grudging respect for his Hillsdale alums who've gone on to clerk on the Supreme Court. But you like to poke fun at lawyers. Maybe that's what Churchill's doing here, is a soldier having fun with the lawyers.
Yeah, well, it's you know, this is a I reread this, of course, for this conversation, and this is a very, and you have to understand about Churchill. Churchill is stepping back here from these huge events in which he was involved, And his main concern is not to interpret them or even relate them. Interpret them is his main. He wants to show what they mean. And Herbert Andrew Asquith was a very successful prime minister who presided over disasters for Great Britain. The loss of British world power happened in two stages, the First and the Second World Wars. And Churchill was trying to prevent those things, and Asquith was too, but was unable. And so he thinks
Asquith
about
had great instincts, but maybe not. But we'll talk about that. Lloyd George ended up being the leader, but we'll talk about that. Don't go anywhere, because we are in the same period right now of danger and ambiguity and strategic folly that Asquith presided over before the First World War. Stay tuned. Dr. Arnold will be right back on the Hillsdale Dialogue.
Coming soon on The Larry Arn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar Ian McGilchrist.
Probably the most important things I learned were not actually in the classroom, but they were from the wise people who taught me. First of all, they taught with an enthusiasm such that, as Plato says in the seventh letter, a spark goes from the one to the other and settles in the mind or soul of the other person. And that's how it was, that there was a, I caught fire with whatever it was they were interested in. And it was more than just information. It was a way of seeing things. And I also, in a way, not consciously, but I suppose everyone does this, takes people as a model.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College president Larry Arn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
Welcome back, America. The Hillsdale Dialogue is underway. We are in the penultimate week in the book called Great Contemporaries, which I'm holding up here for people watching on the Salem News Channel. And we're going in 2 weeks to this book, The World Crisis, Volume 1, which is maybe Churchill's greatest volume of work. I know Marlborough is Dr. Arn's favorite, but Dr. Larry Arn is my guest, president of Hillsdale College. I think this may be my favorite now, the first volume of The World Crisis, Dr. Arn. But before we get there, H.H. Asquith, a couple of quotes that Churchill used about him. Nature never draws a line without smudging it. And if one is to select Asquith's greatest characteristic, this massive finality stands forth, for good or ill, beyond all others, a mind that open and shut smoothly and exactly like the breech of a gun. He also says Asquith was, quote, the finest scholar of his year and the most accomplished speaker in Oxford debates. This is high praise, but of a sort, Dr. Arn.
Yeah, that's right. And he, you know, in the end, what he's saying, without saying it, about Asquith, is that he wasn't the greatest. There are people in the British history for whom Churchill gives unreserved praise. Asquith is not one of them, but he's interesting to Churchill, and Churchill studied him. Churchill was a much younger man and came to prominence with him and had his greatest political trauma under him. And so he studied him. And there's another feature. Churchill writes, his children are his best memorial, and their lives recount and revive his qualities. There's an extremely interesting story about Churchill and two of those children. One of them started as a young officer in the First World War, and by the time it was over, he was a brigadier general. One of them was killed on the Somme, and was a tremendous soldier in the Grenadier Guards. But the other one was, he was in the Royal Naval Division, and that means he was under Churchill's command as First Lord of the Admiralty, and he fought at Antwerp. Churchill deployed the Royal Naval Division to defend the Belgian city of Antwerp and to delay the Germans in their advance down toward trying to flank the French to the German right along the coast. And Churchill sent a thing to the cabinet, a message to the cabinet saying, maybe I should resign my position and become a general in command here. And he was, of course, a ball of fire. Well, Asquith's son was in that force. That had to do with Churchill. And he fought very well, and Churchill fought well, too, although the cabinet thought Churchill was crazy when they got that.
They needed him to come home, too. He wanted to stay in Antwerp.
And that's one of the kids, right? And this, you got to know this about Asquith's second wife was named Margot, M-A-R-G-O-T. And she knew the great actress Jean Harlow, you know, the blonde before Marilyn Monroe. And Jean, they didn't like each other. And Jean Harlow would call her Margot. And so Margot Asquith once said, no, Jean, the T is silent, as in Harlow.
That's going to go over the head of all the Steelers fans, Dr. Arne, you know?
Yeah.
They're not going to get that at all. But Violet Bonham Carter is the other one, right? And she is a big deal in Churchill's life.
He loved that woman for many, many long years. And they were very close. And she was a liberal, and Churchill was a liberal for a time, and she never left it. And but she was just riveting, and he writes about her, too. But there's a story about her that's really great. When they were young together, Churchill would memorize poetry. He's very good at that. And one of his favorites was by Arthur Hugh Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H, which say not, N-O-T, the struggle not, N-O-U-G-H-T, availeth. And it's a very noble poem. It's about keeping on when everything looks desperate. I sent it to a friend of mine the other day because she was a little down. I haven't memorized, but here's a stanza from it. If hopes were dupes, fears may be liars. It may be in yon smoke concealed. Your comrades chase even now the flyers, and but for you possess the field. So they learned that together. And you can just think what kind of young people, a girl and a boy, they were not intimate, they were not romantic, but they were, and they memorized that together. Well, in 1940...
Hold on, I don't want to interrupt that story. We're going to come back. Hold on to that poem, and hold on to the idea of Violet Bonham Carter and Churchill, Carter being the daughter of Asquith. We'll be back with that. Welcome back, America. Dr. Larry Arne and I are talking about H.H. Asquith, and we're running up to World War I as we are running up to some great struggle right now with the People's Republic of China, and I don't know how it's going to go, but we haven't got leaders like Winston Churchill, H.H. Asquith, and Lady Violet Bonham Carter running around. What was the poem story, Danilo? What happened?
Well, in 1940, Churchill used that poem in a speech, in one of his broadcast speeches, one of his most important ones, and that's in the summer of 1940 when they might be invaded any day and they're being bombed. And the last one is, you know, he used it for America. The last one ends, in front the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward look, the land is bright. That was an appeal to us to come and help.
Yes.
Well, after he signed off on the radio, he called her, Violet. And he said, Violet, did you hear our poem? And she was streaming with tears.
Oh.
That's a big thing, isn't it? It's wonderful. And that's Asquith's family. And what Churchill is able to do in all of these essays, it's like Plutarch's Lives, by the way. Plutarch, the ancient historian, wrote what are called parallel lives. He picked a Greek and a Roman who had similar careers, and he compared them and told their stories. And one thing you learn is almost none of them end in happiness. You know, heroes whose names we know, you know, Themistocles and Pericles and
Hector.
And this is like that, right? He reveals to us, it's a wonderful practice, right, about people who make big decisions that affect us all, and what are their qualities and what are their limitations and how do they go about it? And Churchill was a practitioner of that, but also a student of it and a teacher of it in these essays.
One of the things he writes about Asquith, address and charm in conversation, the nice taste in words, the ready pen and readier tongue, the unmistakable air of probity and independence, and the unconscious sense of superiority that sprang from these belonged as of native right to both Herbert Asquith and his father. I guess you might also say it also belonged to Lady Bonham Carter, Lady Violet Bonham Carter. But Asquith, who could be won over in an argument, but Churchill said you had to carefully marshal it, put it in writing, print it clearly, and he would read it at law. And in cabinet, he was markedly silent. Indeed, he never spoke a word in council if he could get away with it. It's just a remarkable kind of leader with which we are not familiar today, Dr. Arndt.
Well, you know, that reminds one a little bit of Reagan. He would sit, you know, some of the indiscreet cabinet members would write about how he didn't say much in the cabinet. But if you just put all the stories together, what you find out is that what he said was decisive. And Asquith was like that. Also, we have to notice one of Churchill's best phrases. He talks about his letters. In the book, in Great Contemporaries, he reproduces one of Asquith's letters to Churchill, appointing him to an office. And he says they're very compact. They're compressed. You know, they're all written out longhand. He doesn't dictate. Churchill did all that. But he says he wrote other letters, and he's talking about letters he wrote during cabinet meetings. He wrote several letters a day to a woman. Churchill says they were addressed to brighter eyes than peer through politician spectacles. That's pretty good. Yeah. And, of course, that lady was a lady named Venetia Stanley, with whom, let's say, Asquith had close relations.
Yes.
And so he was writing her several times a day, and you talked about his ability to turn off business in the middle of a cabinet meeting. He could do that.
Yeah. I got to read this line. The habit formed, this is Churchill writing about Asquith, mind. The habit formed in the life of a busy lawyer, persisted. The case was settled and put aside. Judgment was formed, was delivered, and did not require review. His mind was so lucid, so well stored, so thoroughly trained that once he had heard the whole matter thrashed out, the conclusion came with a snap, and each conclusion, as far as it was possible, was final. Now, I don't think that's a great habit, Dr. Arndt. What do you think Churchill is saying about that?
Well, that's right, because Churchill writes about this in terms that are very similar to Aristotle. Practical judgment involves the circumstances. They're the staple of what goes into a practical judgment. What's going on, and what's going to happen if I do this, and what's going to happen if I do that? And circumstances are always changing. And Churchill is, you know, really good at that. Asquith, Churchill is saying, was too quick to put it to bed. And I hasten to add that's not advice to which you're prone, because every time you have a court case, you make a national thing of it.
I try to, yes.
It's, you know, that's, and you parse it out and analyze it and keep thinking about it. You know, that's the mode, right? And that's one reason, by the way, why the life of practical wisdom is urgently necessary, but it's lower than the life of contemplating high things.
We talked last week about the Harvard case and the Alexandria High School that is discriminating on the basis of race. And I think I've been talking about using race in admissions for 35 years, and it's never a closed case because it won't go away.
Right.
Despite the fact that repeatedly the court has ruled that the use of race to award benefits or inflict penalties is prohibited by our Constitution because of our country's unfortunate and tragic history with using race. And it's
Go ahead. And remember, what's at stake in that is something important to you, and that is if the law is a respecter of persons in any way outside their own equal souls and what they do with them, right, then the rule of law breaks down. And that means that the people in that high school are trying to pick and choose according to criteria other than capacity to do the work in high school.
And that's such a terrible thing. It's such a departure from everything based on merit.
Yeah, and that's, because I've got so much of my education in a college, you know, in graduate school, but now running a college is even better education. One of the things you learn early is that the student has to do the learning, because each, we have to learn together, but each individual achievement in learning happens in the individual human soul, and they can't do it unless they want to, you see? And that means that, you know, if you think the most important thing about any kid in front of you is the color of the kid's skin, you don't know what a human being is or how the human being functions.
Amen. And I wonder how you keep your admissions, because you're being overwhelmed with admissions, because everybody wants to go to Hillsdale now, and I'm glad. But there are only so many chairs, right? How many chairs do you get to admit? You get to admit twice your capacity? Is that what you get to do?
No, not quite that much now. We have a top 10 yield rate, it's called, which means we have a big wait list and we don't use it much. 62% of the ones we admit show up here.
Wow.
And
That's a lot.
Because, you know, I mean, it's what's not to like about this?
You are not a, quote, backup school. You are the primary objective. They fire the torpedo. They want to hit Hillsdale.
That's it. Yeah, and that's, and you know, good things will happen to you here, very likely. And that's what the kids, you know, because first of all, you got to be kind of serious to come to Hillsdale because, you know, it's, I was at the University of Chicago, I think, for the first time in my life, last Friday. A bunch of kids put together a conference on the pandemic. It was really interesting. And, you know, a bunch of famous people. Jonathan Turley was there, and Jay Bhattacharya was there, and all kinds of fancy people. And I was the keynote speaker. And I stood up at the end and I said, you know, I think one thing I can do that's valuable to sum all this up is just to state in clear terms what a college is. Because some of us don't seem to know. It's a bunch of, you know, first of all, Aristotle says in the first paragraph of the Politics, every community seems to aim at some good, right? You can't form a community unless you have a common object. And then what is the object? The object is to know, in the case of common college students, to know things that will be valuable for the rest of your life. You haven't started your work yet. And then there are two things that follow from that. And one is, because speaking and reasoning are the same thing, we are empowered, unique in nature, to learn together. We can share everything. But on the other hand, we have each of us to do it to benefit, too. And so the first thing about a college is everybody's got to want to, and they've got to want to do the same thing. And you know, to admit a bunch of 18-year-olds to represent a certain position on some big question so you have a balance. First of all, nobody represents anything.
That's such a dumb objective.
Everybody's trying to look at the source, as Aristotle loves to say, and figure out what it means.
And that's not going to happen.
It's another thing is, that's the reason you don't run a college by rules, right? You don't. You have to have goals, because people are self-motivated, and they do have to agree to the goals in the grand sense before they come, and they have to know that's very serious, and it even has to be in the context of discouraging them not to come. What we say is, look, there's 100 options, there's 1,000, there are 4,000 options out there. Go to one of them. We don't care. But if you come to this one, this is what this one does. And we didn't
and
do
that's
it.
That's why you're being overwhelmed with applications. And that's a good thing. Apply to Hillsdale. Go to hillsdale.edu. Grab the application. Send it in if you're serious about it. Dr. Arnn and I will be back to conclude HH Ask With in just a moment.
Coming soon on The Larry Arnn Show, psychiatrist, writer, and literary scholar, Ian McGilchrist.
You are such an interesting man, living off on an island off Scotland, but I think that your books amount to a campaign to make us use the rest of our brain.
It's very interesting because, of course, I would never think of them as like that, and they're not intended in that way. I am, I suppose, pleased, but I'm very accepting of whatever happens. Generally, I think it's a sensible way to look at life. But I have been noticing that more and more people in more and more areas are referring to my work. and finding it relevant. And I'm very pleased by that, as by the response of readers, which is endlessly touching.
Don't miss this conversation between Ian McGilchrist and Hillsdale College president Larry Arn. Subscribe now to The Larry Arn Show at podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe.
Welcome back, America. H.H. Asquith is a great guy. He could not run a war. And at the end, Churchill writes about him in Great Contemporaries. He could not keep the country, the United Kingdom's confidence during the war. It demanded a frenzied energy at the summit, an effort to compel events rather than adjudicate them wisely and deliberately. Lloyd George was needed. Quote, the vehement, contriving, resourceful, nimble-leaping Lloyd George. And when Asquith fell, he fell with dignity, bore adversity with composure, in or out of power, disinterested patriotism, and inflexible integrity were his only guides. We got about 6 minutes. Why is the character of a Lloyd George needed in a war and not the character of an Asquith, Dr. Arn? It's really a very pregnant paragraph.
Well, because people are killing each other, and they're constantly contriving how to do that better, and you have to adjust. And then, because it's the ultimate test, because it commands the death of even one of Asquith's own sons, that it's very urgent, right? And you have to keep your noggin working. Lloyd George was a heck of a guy, and since he closes by praising him as a better war leader, remember, the First World War was an incredible disaster, and Churchill broke his sword trying to find a way to cheapen its cost in life, and didn't get it done, right? And Asquith, on a certain night, Churchill's not bitter about it, he didn't even mention it in this essay, on a certain night, Churchill went to Asquith and said, order the admiral to attack again at the Dardanelles, and Asquith wouldn't do it. And the whole thing foundered, and the government came apart. Churchill lost his job, and the effort was wasted. Another thing, the Dardanelles was cursed by divided counsel and chopping and changing the policy all the way through. Are we going to do it ships only? Are we going to have troops? They started ships only. The troops were supplied. That caused a delay. The troops didn't move fast. They got outflanked. Everything went wrong, and that's because it was not coordinated properly. And that is laid at the feet of Asquith.
And it's an indictment that cannot be escaped.
That's right.
Because it was a disaster. And but so he stuck with Edwin Gray, which is great. He gets praise for that. But they really, this is why we're going to spend so much time on 1911, 1914. They didn't know what they were about, Dr. Arn.
No, they didn't. And you know, in a contrast, Churchill regarded, he wrote later, that the Second World War was much easier to avoid than the First World War, because people had learned from the First World War and that they drew the wrong lesson. But if they just acted quickly, as soon as Hitler started making weapons against the law, against the treaties they'd signed, if they just stopped him, there wouldn't have been that war, right?
Do you agree with me that the run-up to World War I is more important to our current moment than the run-up to World War II?
You'd have to take them both together to find all the elements we got right now. There is one big power that's the problem, and that's like in World War II, right? Everybody knew what it was. They were despotic. They were aggressive. They were threatening their neighbors and taking some of their neighbors, right? That's like World War II. But the distraction of our politics is worse than the run-up to World War One. I mean, we're not building weapons as fast as the rate of inflation, and yet we got a problem. And so, in other words, we are, and we're falling into debt massively all the time, and we can't make a budget. So that's, it's, you know, in a way, we're not nearly as well put together as Great Britain was in 1914.
Okay, I'll venture a rough analogy. The Irish Home Rule question is to those years as domestic politics is to our ears. It's all consuming and it's avoiding the major point.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, you have to understand, the liberals came in 1904 and Churchill with them. And they, you know, they were divided between the Little Englanders, you know, that's pullback, and the imperialist liberals. But they built a big navy, and they, you know, it come to find out, conditions had changed to the place that the navy was not dispositive in the way that it had been in the great big wars that Britain won against, you know, Philip V and the Spanish Armada, and against Napoleon. But they had their military was as well prepared as it was reasonable to expect, and even a little better than that.
And Kirchner said to Churchill when he was fired, at least you can always say the fleet was ready. And it was, because Asquith gave him a grunt.
That's right. If we could have the Liberal Party governing us, trading all the other prospects, you can have Asquith and the Liberal Party for 10 years, or you can have whatever comes. I'd pick Asquith.
So would I, because at least he would give you the grunt. More on the run-up to World War One next week, the Kaiser, and then on to this book, The World Crisis. Go and order it now. Dr. Larry Arnn, thank you. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu, including that application. And for all the dialogues, just go to iTunes, type in Hillsdale Dialogue, and find 800 of them. I'll be back, America. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to the Hillsdale Dialogues, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. More episodes at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your audio. For more information about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu.